When you come in on Monday and you're not feeling real well, does anyone ever say to you, sounds like someone has a case of the Mondays?
No. No, man. No, man. I believe you get your ass kicked saying something like that, man.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Oh. Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
Oh, it's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down.
Well, welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tamal. We got Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures down 6.15. NASDAQ futures down 14. We'll see. We've got the CPI coming out. Let's get the... Right from the Wednesday, we have CPI. And Thursday we have PPI, so it's the other way around this month. Not sure how they decide which month one comes before the other, but this month it's CPI before PPI. So there you go.
If anyone's watching the grains, we've got a WASDE report on Wednesday too.
Is that Beeks?
Beeks is in.
What exactly
Wednesday
is the WASDE
morning,
report?
Wednesday morning, and that's probably released at 11. So look for fireworks at 11:01.
What is that report going to tell us?
It tells us about the beginning of the crop season. So we're going to find out kind of how much is planted. We're going to find out expected, just anything related to the beginning of the harvest, or not the harvest, the beginning of planting, excuse me.
Where are we? We are June, 8th, 9th, 10th, right? Am I correct? I
think yes.
I am. So by June 10th, everybody, even the most northern latitude, everybody should be in, or how does that work?
For, call it the row crops, oil seeds and grains, and most of, I believe, of the wheat. So beans, corn, those are the ones that we watch, and it's the World Agriculture Supply and Demand Estimate is what it's called. So WASDE is what we shorten it to.
All right, so we're not just talking us. We're talking Ukraine and Argentina. Well, Argentina's not playing this time of the year, but...
The only numbers we're looking at are us, really.
Ah. I mean,
Brazil has some, I think, taxes on the block. So they're voting on actually to increase export taxes for some of their crops, which would help U.S. farmers. But we'll see about that. I mean, mostly, you know, we're setting up for this season.
So what do we think Beeks is going to say?
Right now, they're mostly watching for funds setting up to be more short, which is interesting considering they just bought a whole lot of their shorts in. But with good weather, which it seems like we have, and it could, the beans and the corn at least could keep going down.
It seemed like my short stuff I drive through on the southwest side, those guys were a little late because of the rain, but boy, the stuff they have in is already coming up.
Right.
So if you got the stuff
if
in,
it's looking good. And yeah, a lot of people have been saying, at least in the Gulf and the Atlantic, are the water temperatures are abnormally warm right now. So that could mean more severe weather for the rest of the season, especially in hurricanes season, which could, you know, throw more more precipitation our way.
We're supposedly having one of the fastest switches from El Nino to La Nina ever. It was a heavy El Nino last year, which kept us warm in the winter and everything else, and then the opposite of that, obviously, is El Nino is normally abnormally warm Pacific waters off South and Central America. La Nina is the opposite. It kind of goes one to the other over time, and a lot of times it's neutral. But this time it's flinging from El Nino, which is warm, to La Nina, which is cold, like, you know, who knows record time. I mean, because we've only been charting this stuff for, you know, what small piece of time. But it's going faster than we've ever seen it before.
Yeah, and a lot of people talk about derivatives and such, and, you know, the evils or whatever it is, you know, the contracts that we trade in the futures. Really, we're just a derivative of the weather. So,
well, and the farmers and the prices and last year's prices and how much is in storage and
yeah, mostly the weather.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, once it's in the ground, it's the weather.
Yeah.
What happens if that hailstorm that hit about a month ago? What if that hits during the prime season?
You know, that could damage fields. Normally, those storms aren't as big as to seriously affect. They could affect transportation. They could affect not as much national yields, but it could happen if they get crops get damaged. You know, that's
well, it's a localized thing.
Right.
It could happen to you for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, it shredded my tomatoes.
Yeah.
And Audrey's oak tree's got like half the leaves it's supposed to have. I mean, if that would have happened, of course, maybe can't happen when it's warmer. But there's all kinds of car damage, everything out in the southwest suburbs.
Yeah,
that was pretty serious stuff. I mean, a lot of roofs, a lot of everything got messed up. But yeah, you have to be careful that you don't hedge your whole crop, right? Or if you do, you buy puts and don't sell the stuff.
If you sell the stuff, you you become. You become, let's call it vulnerable, because if you end up having to deliver that stuff and you don't have it, you know, you're one of those naked shorts.
Yeah.
And if you don't cover, or at least call it buy a call, you know, most of them would buy puts or sell futures, but if you start seeing weather problems or something where you're not going to be able to deliver as much as you've sold, you've got a serious problem. So you need to limit risk, and that's where the calls usually come in.
Well, what Greg is talking about is the simple deal is, I'll keep it.
It's very similar to kind of what the GameStop people are doing. They're thinking there's not enough and not enough supply, so they're trying to buy up a lot of the supply so it's not able to be loaned out.
Well, the supply is the stuff that's outstanding. Anyway, but if a farmer says, all right, I got my stuff in the ground, it cost me $2. The price is $4. That sounds pretty good to me. I'm going to have, you know, 100,000 bushels. Guess what? I will sell 20 contracts, which is 100,000 bushels, right?
Yep.
And at $4, and I'm good to go. So if the
until the hail destroys your crop,
you don't have it.
And so the price is going up in your future that you've sold, which would be okay normally because you have the physical to deliver. However, if you've lost a chunk of it due to weather or due to whatever and you don't have it to deliver, all of a sudden you're short futures. If you can only produce 10...
And you got trouble.
And you've got 20 futures on, that means that you're short. And most people would try to cover that, you know, ASAP because there's no limit. There's unlimited loss potential. Because if it keeps going that way...
Well, if your damage happens the first week and the futures don't have a chance to move and you just cover them, you're probably, you know, got out by the skin of your teeth. But if it happens late in the year when you actually think you got a great crop and all of a sudden you don't. So most farmers will make a determination, you know, I'll sell half or I'll sell a quarter.
And that's part of good risk management.
And then maybe I'll buy puts on the rest.
Right.
Meaning I'll buy the $4 puts. If it runs back down to $2, you know, whatever I paid for the put.
Then you're locked in.
Yeah, you're locked in. So... you do one thing or the other. You know, when my brother Dan, who's president of PTI, before that, he was on the trading floor, both on the CBOE and on the Board of Trade floor, and he was I think he did corn options. Pretty sure he did. And he was, he was always into the state of Indiana. I think Greg had a new government program that said, look, instead of doing all this crop insurance and futures and all this other stuff, why don't we just subsidize people to buy puts? So they did, and after, I don't know, it was a one-year program or two or three, but after a few years, they decided it was a very successful program, and then they canceled it. It's too simple, right? You know, not enough people you employ doing that.
Not enough, what's it called?
Juice, a little yeah. juice. Not enough people could wet their beak, as they say. Not enough grease. We should have John coming in a while. We might have Kevin's going to call in a little bit. I hope to talk about another one of my favorites down the tubes, Chet Walker, star
I'm
of the.
To, I'm here to talk some Chet to Jack.
Oh, all right. That's for those that back in the Dick Motta days in the '60s when I was a huge Bulls fan, and actually when I was in college I was a huge Bulls fan, and there was a bar because you know you didn't have like TV like now. I feel like the two little kids talking about they didn't have internet back then.
We had TVs then.
Well, you didn't have TVs like now. I said, we had the TV, but you didn't have any stations. So if you wanted to watch, like, Channel 9, which I believe the Bulls were on, or the Hawks, you had to go down in South Bend. Because we had the antenna up on the roof of the dorm. I would get there 2 days before anybody else, and I would sneak up on the roof and hook our TV, our black and white TV, into one of the UHF antennas on the roof. So we always had a TV, but if you wanted something from Chicago, like say the Bulls or the Bears or something, you needed to go to some place with a big high antenna. They would get kind of a semi-grainy picture of, they would actually pick up the Chicago signal. There was this little bar in South Bend called Samaris, and there was never anybody in the place. So we'd go sit down there at the bar, and Greg, I don't know if you'd like this, $1.35 pitchers of Drury's and 59-cent meatball sandwiches that were actually very good. And we'd watch the games. And but the Bulls had a really good team with Dick Motta. I remember the starting lineup. It was Chet Walker, Bob Love, Tom Bornwinkle in the middle, Jerry Sloan, and Norm Van Leer. Right? And then they had a bunch of, who were the guys that came off the bench? Who's the guy that had the weirdo outside shot? They had McCoy McLemore. They had, how did they ever get Chet Walker, who I think was drafted? He went to Bradley, by the way. And he was on the...
Went to Bradley and was a high school star at Benton Harbor... Benton Township High School here in Southwest Michigan.
Well, I did not know that. But Chet was one hell of a player. And he was on the, allegedly, the greatest team ever assembled, which was, what, the 76ers? That they beat Boston. It was Will Chamberlain. Was it Gus Johnson? Chet Walker, Hal Greer, another Hall of Famer, and Wally, what's his last name? Wally Johnson? Wally Jones.
Jones.
And who ended up winning a title, I believe, in Milwaukee as well. When was he Lew Alcindor his rookie year? Or was he Kareem Abdul-Jabbar already?
Yeah, I think he was still Lew Alcindor.
For like 1 year in the NBA?
Yeah, something like that.
And,
The 76ers had Chamberlain, they had Hal Greer, who was a great player. Walker, Luke Jackson, Wally Jones, and then coming off the bench, Billy Cunningham.
Well, I'm going to say to this day, the forward, Gus Johnson, was one of those 6'10", just big, big guys. That was
Luke Jackson.
Luke Jackson. And he, you know, when he went up for a dunk before they had the tearaway rims, sometimes the backboard would shatter, that kind of thing. Those two guys had to be the most intimidating two people on the floor at the same time in the history of basketball. Maybe, who were the two big guys, the bookends that... Ralph Sampson, and who was the other guy in the same team?
Akeem.
Yeah, and those guys might have been close, but strength-wise, I don't think they came close to you, to Wilton, Luke. Anyway,
it was I would say no, because you could put Wilt and me on there, and I don't think you'd come close in terms of strength.
Yeah, Wilt was a special sort of dude, but... So he came. I don't know how the hell they got him out of Philadelphia. Well, Philadelphia got rid of Wilt, right? He went to the Lakers, and then somehow they got rid of Chet to the Bulls for Bob Boozer. Wasn't that good? And it was later in his career, and Dick Motta who was a coach, wanted to extend Chet's career. So he held him in those days to, what, 30-some minutes a game?
Low 30s, yeah.
And no matter what happened, no matter what, Chet would not play more than low 30s. He wasn't a Tom Thibodeau that we're going to, you know, we're going to restrict his minutes after coming back from an injury, and then, of course, he needs him and pays him 45. But Wilt played, what, 48 the whole every game the whole year? I mean, he did that.
Chamberlain was just, you know, I don't think he was 48, but he was close.
Well, the one year he was more than the minutes, right, because of the overtimes? He was more than 48 times over many games they played.
Yeah, he was in 61-62. He actually played 48.5 minutes per game.
It's funny when you talk about him versus Shaq, and somebody will say, well, gee, Shaq might have been as good or better. Shaq played 32 minutes. How does a guy who plays two-thirds of the time as good as a guy who plays the whole time? Just saying. Just on that alone, you would think that. Anyway, so what did you think of the game last night? If Kyrie Irving continues to play the way he is, that's going to be a four-game series because he didn't do squat.
Yeah, it wasn't it wasn't pretty. it was a good game for a while, but what, about 7-8 minutes left to go is when the Celtics started not throwing the knockout punch.
Well, for a long time they were what, 4 of 25 from 3 points, the Celtics, and they were still up, which leads you to believe how kind of crummy the other guys played, Dallas, but Chet was for some reason he never got the status he should have had in the NBA. And I think a lot of it had to do with he was a very independent guy. He was already kind of a movie producer or something, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But somehow...
TV producer. If you look at him, because I believe he got in the Hall of Fame as via the Veterans Committee. I'm looking at his basketball reference page, and everything is in the top 100 somewhere. So as you start to look at him, 7 All-Star games, as a college player, he was at Bradley, first team All-American twice and second team All-American once. If you look at his career points, he's 71st. If you look at his All-League, he was Rookie of the Year. If you look at his points per game, those are all season ones. total rebounds career, NBA 93rd, 98th if you count playoffs. Then rebounds per game, field goal percentage, 6 seasons in the top 20. He was really good around the basket. His free throw percentage, 7 seasons in the top 20, including first in the NBA, 70-71. You can start ticking down the numbers of, you know, field goal, 2-point field goals, because there really weren't a lot of 3-point field goals in those days. 61st. If you start looking at career free throw attempts, 42nd. If you look at minutes played, he's 100th on the button for regular and playoffs. Career regular. Just career NBA. I'd have to see what the difference is for that. He's 94th. So he's really, he's one of those guys. You look at efficiency ratings, 50th in the career NBA. Offensive win shares, career NBA, 78.4, which puts him 43rd. He's a top 100, pushing towards the top 50 type of player all time, at least statistically speaking. And if you look at what he, for those of us who saw him play, knew that he was an incredibly tough defender, that he was, he was kind of a garbage man, because you get a lot of offensive rebounds and putbacks, which is great. You need those guys. He was just a really terrific all-around player, and paired with Bob Love at the other forward, they were hellacious defenders, along with Sloan and Van Leer in the backcourt. These guys, they got at it. And he and Love both made All-Star teams a couple of times together, as both, the teammates on the All-Star team. So
the only teams they had trouble with on that team, because, boy, I was a rabid fan, were the teams with big big, huge centers. They had trouble against Wilt. They had trouble against Jabbar. And they had trouble against Bill Walton a little bit. So they lost the team. What was the year that the center?
Keep in mind also that in those days, there was a strictly enforced no zone rule. You had to guard somebody. You had to be man-to-man. So, yes, Borwinkle was going to be a tough matchup with the top centers in the league.
Well, they were a big forward denominated offense. And what was the year that the center, Willis Reed, came out when he was hurt? And even though he only played a few minutes, they thought he was out for the series, and he came out in a big, you know, the emotional
thing. He only played a few minutes, but he inspired everybody, yeah.
But that was – who did they beat that year? Was that Seattle or Portland? I mean,
hold on.
They might have. Well, my point is that the Bulls had a tough time getting out of the. They were in the West in those days, so they had a tough time getting out of the West because they always had to go up against either Chamberlain or, I think they lost to Chamberlain. They lost to the Lakers, and but the Bulls. Whenever I saw them play the Knicks in person, like three times, they murdered the Knicks because Willis Reed. Even though he was a really good center, was only 6'9". He wasn't enough to mess with them like Chamberlain or Jabbar. But and Chet Walker totally dominated Bill Bradley. I mean, he was bigger, stronger. He was everything better than Bill Bradley. And Bob Love was kind of the equivalent of Dave DeBuscher. And in the backcourt, you had I'm not so sure who the other guard was when Walt Frazier in those years. I think it was before Monroe got there. But the every time they played the Knicks, they clobbered them. It seemed like it. Yet, but they never got there because they had to go through either Chamberlain or Bill Walton on the other end. So it's, you know, very very interesting. I don't know with Bill, because Portland beat him the 1 year with Lionel Hollins threw the one in from a million miles. Did Chet ever play with a 3-point line? When did the 3-point line come in, Kevin?
No, give me a second. I'm still figuring out who was on the Lakers when the Willis Reed 1970 team beat him.
So well, it had to be Wilt. Because I remember Chet Walker saying that Wilt was a real problem. He goes, you said he blocks three of my shots and like messes with like five more because he's just that big. But I remember Oscar Robertson, of all people, who was the guy in the Lakers that was already older when considering one of the greatest forwards ever? What the hell is his name? The big, you know, he was a... but they asked Oscar Robertson who was better, Chet or who am I talking about, Kevin? The Laker forward that was like older when Wilt got there?
Elgin Baylor.
And he said, who was better? And said, Oscar said, well, for me, Chet's a lot better. He was bigger, stronger, better on defense. I had much more trouble against Chet than I ever did against Elgin Baylor.
Yeah, Baylor was a great player, a Hall of Fame player, 6'5" only, though.
Yeah.
And 6'5" wasn't ungodly short. You know, you fast forward 10 years, and you get like guys like Barkley and Adrian Dantley who were defying the odds because they were 6'5". But in those days, you know, Chet Walker was 6'7", so he could be a power forward at 6'7".
And
but yes, you're right. The Lakers of that year were the Wilt Chamberlain, Elgin Baylor, Keith Erickson, etc. You're trying to when did the 3-point line come in? So NBA 3.
I'm going to say after that because I was playing long after that and I never played with a 3-point line. I'm going to say almost 80. Maybe later.
Yeah, my search crapped out. There it is. History of the 3-pointer, USA basketball, 3-point field goal.
84.
Greg, I Googled you.
Yeah. Well, it's happened before.
So for FIBA, it was 84.
FIBA.
In the NBA, it was what? 79-80.
79-80.
Magic,
okay.
Johnson, Larry Bird.
All right.
It was a trial basis.
Well, that lasted a while. No.
Yeah. Oh, and they didn't they have to because the ABA was using it and they wanted to compete.
I think the Olympics started to use it too, right?
Could be, but I don't think the NBA cared at that point, because they didn't contribute to the Olympics until 92.
That's true. Well, Kevin, thank you. We should have Mr. Flanagan in. If we start talking some, he's going to do some research on European politics and talk about this French election. If you want to pipe back in, feel free. SP Futures down 4.75. NASDAQ Futures down 11. I'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks and jocks. Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now.
The Dow where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Low and open Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures down 3.25. As that futures only down 3.75, they were down more, but it looks to me like we're to the moon on so many stocks, and it's not going to stop. I've got CrowdStrike up another $18 today, and I mean in terms of times revenue, I don't even want to talk about what that number is. I mean, it's just look it up yourself, check it out. I mean, we're talking stocks 4%, 5%, 6%, 7% a day. What's the difference? I mean, it is so much like 2000 in that regard, in one man's opinion, but. Then again, it's liable to keep going. So, again, I'm long for people, so it's. I'm just questioning it. I'm wondering how long it's going to last, but hopefully it'll last a while, and we'll get out at the right time or make sure we put our puts up at the right time or do something. But over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 105, it's 0.6%, FTSE down 22.3%. CAC around is the one. Chan's going to talk a little about the election over there. They're down almost 130, it's 1.6%. So, whack whack in France is. I think they're going to dissolve Parliament and have a new snap election and all kinds of stuff that we'll talk about in a minute. We've got the Nikkei up 354.9%, Hang Seng down 109.6%, 18,366, Shanghai up 2, call that flat. Friday, as a way of review, Dow was down 87, S&P down 6, NASDAQ down 40, so down but not very much. Bonds, 4 basis points, 4.47. The Bund up 5 basis points, 2.67. Japan up 6, back over 1%, 1.04. It's a pretty big move, 6% for those guys, or 6 cents. Oil up 23 cents, 75.76. Brent up 27 cents, 79.89. Natural gas up 9 cents, 301. God, what a nice buy it. Why don't we, do we buy some of this at 168? Do I have it in some account somewhere? So just forgot about it, Greg, or no? I think maybe not, huh? RBOB unchanged at 238. We've got gold, which got absolutely destroyed on Friday. Down 7, 23.17. Some Chinese number came out saying they weren't buying any gold or something. So between that and the move in the dollar, we just torpedoed gold. Silver, however, is up 43 cents, 29.87, 1.5%. We've got Bitcoin down 385, 69,360, under 70 again. We have the U.S. dollar, which was dropping a little bit. Now it's stronger today, so the euro's on down to 107. It was almost 108 on Friday. British pound down to 127, so the dollar is definitely stronger today. A lot of crazy stuff going on. Greg, what do you got for us? Trevi Weather Sports.
Morning, everyone. 6:36 here in Chicago. 54 today, high of 63, sunny and breezy. Phoenix, a little bit chilly today, 56 right now, high of 65 there. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 22 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook is 38 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 31 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 16 minutes. And Stevenson, 294 to the Ryan, is 24 minutes. MLB Cubs beat Cincy. That was 4-2. White Sox lose to Red Sox at home. That was 6-4. Arizona beat San Diego at San Diego. That was 9-3. NBA Finals, Game 2. Celtics win 105-98. That was at home. NHL Stanley Cup is tonight. Oilers at Panthers. Panthers lead that series 1-0. And that's all I got, Chief.
So the NBA is not going to play again until Wednesday. So this goes 7. Are we talking 4th of July? What are we doing here? I mean, are they extending this far enough or what? just saying, you know, whatever. Here's the Euro slides to 1 month low after Macron calls snap French election. So it has taken excess. It's a big move in the Euro dollar. It's a crazy.
You jumping into currencies?
No, you know what though? Sometimes when you're talking about gold and oil and stuff, it is the game, right? They're all tied together.
Definitely.
Is the there's no Euro dollar crowd now, is there? Is it all electronic?
Are you talking futures or are you talking the currency crosses?
The futures.
I think the last time that I saw that was a long time ago.
There used to be how many people in crowd? 400 or something?
Yeah, a lot. The big trader in the Euro dollar futures was Marge Teller, who eventually made her way to soybean oil and meal.
Really?
Yeah.
That's wild. I mean, I was in the OAX when there were 300 and some people, but...
They call her Large Marge.
She
had positions as big as Citigroup, and they paid her to come back when she left the first time.
Wow.
The CME did.
It's so bizarre because all that pit was all trading the same product. Well, the 30-year, 10-year bond was a pretty big crowd, too, and everybody's trading the same thing, right?
Right.
Where in the OEX, at least, there are people who trade the out month and their month. There's a million different strikes. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you could concentrate on. But in those things, I don't know what I would do in a pit where there's only one market. The whole world is one bid at two. What are you? One bid at two. Okay, well, that's cool. Do we have Mr. Flanagan?
Good morning, Tom. Morning, Greg.
How are you?
Good. How about you?
Okay. I'm trying to make sense of this this French election thing. And, of course, I do what I do best. When I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, I call one of you guys. And just as a way of we did have a guest. Somehow Kathy Reardon found a guy from the, I think he was from the, what do you call the dudes that are, the British aren't in there, but they're not in the Finland Parliament. They actually go sit in the Euro Parliament in Brussels, right? Each country gets to elect a couple of guys, like another whole government in Brussels, right? Making rules and stuff for
right.
everybody.
Members of the European Parliament.
But now those guys, I thought that those guys were appointed, but obviously they must not be, at least not in France. But I mean, so what rules do those guys make? They make all the rules regarding commerce, correct? And all that stuff, because I mean,
interstate commerce, you know, passport restrictions, quotas, labeling of, you know, products, copyright, trade, trademark, things like that for you know, policy, as those member nations, you know, send stuff around the world, buy stuff, sell stuff. So it's fairly restrictive, you know, in that you get veto power over your, you know, national authority by all the other member states. So, and they are elected. I mean, I thought one of the gripes for a long time was, you know, a little connection there was between the representation in Brussels and the average person in any of the member states. But these elections are, you know, EU-wide, so they all elected their representatives for the new parliament that's going to be seated this year for five-year terms.
That's a while.
Yeah, and they're salaried positions, so I mean, this is not like volunteer work or anything. And the membership for each nation is capped at 96 members maximum, which Germany is at right now. France,
is it because of population?
Yeah, and the lowest or the minimum number is 6. So even countries like Luxembourg get 6 members. So that there's proportionally, you know, much greater representation of Luxembourgers in the parliament than, say, the Germans or the French. So And the Italians are just behind the French and the Spanish.
Well, what's the total number of these goofballs? It's like 500 or something?
It's 705 in the current parliament. I thought it was more from what I was reading in some regurgitations of the statistics, but it looks like 705, and there's a possibility of increasing this because of population changes.
So how does 705 people make any decisions whatsoever?
Well, this is the great flaw, I think, in any kind of a deliberative body, where something like the EU has clearly started to lose a lot of its gloss with Europeans, and I think the size of it and the political fractions throughout the thing are starting to undercut its effectiveness and its usefulness. So,
well, Chris used to tell us that they would have, that there were, could this even be possibly right, Greg, that there were 25 or was it 200 pages of rules just regarding cabbage?
Yeah. Oh, that probably isn't the most absurd scenario at all. By any,
So the French Parliament.
This is why we had Brexit.
Well, so the French Parliament and the rest of these guys have essentially given total control over all this other stuff that they would normally have done themselves, on commodities and border crossing. They've essentially kicked that over to this Brussels group that has 705 gnomes of some kind that are over there doing God knows what.
Right.
We had one of those representatives on the show here from Finland right after Brexit. God, what a horse's ass that guy was. Wait, like that, I had to say about a guest, but I said something about were you surprised about the Brexit? And he said, well, it's just another example of politicians not keeping their people in line, or something along those lines. I basically said, say what?
that's pretty obnoxious.
Yeah, it was something. Awesome. It was pretty. Maybe those weren't the exact words, but how politicians now.
That is the thinking among a lot of the EU people.
Yeah, but they were not, or didn't educate their population properly, or didn't do their job to let them know the right way. And I'm going, makes you think this wasn't the right way. Maybe they just didn't want you guys. Plus, what did Lou say at the time? Neither one of you guys were here, but that they had just in Britain had come up with some bizarre rules regarding tea makers or something. And the British were all pissed off because they're very into their tea makers. Whatever tea machines were, they had some regulation that they were going to stop the current tea machine from being sold. Some long story about it. He said their timing couldn't have been worse about messing with the British guy's tea or something. And I don't know if that swayed a lot of votes, but they regulate everything evidently to some incredible degree. That's what they do all day. Most have committees on.
Yeah, it's a bureaucratic nightmare because of its size and its, the idea that you would have nations combined because of shared economic interests or mutual defense agreements or things like that is an old and venerable tradition. But I think the EU, the way it's configured now, has turned into a kind of hydra-headed monster.
Well, I'm sure they keep trying to increase their power. I mean, I would just that's the way people are.
Oh, because they're really under attack. I mean, Brexit shook up the EU in ways that its most staunch defenders and partisans never really dreamed. And I don't think David Cameron dreamed what he had unleashed when he called for the referendum on it. And that shows how completely out of touch some of these national governments are with their own brewing problems and their lack of control, and thank God they don't control it, because otherwise it's just a fascist state. But the EU has been severely damaged because of grassroots efforts like Brexit, and they have never forgotten it. They're extremely sensitive to that. If another big nation were to have a similar referendum and would withdraw, it would mean a further marginalizing of its power, and it's already lost tremendous prestige with Brexit.
Well, there's only one news organization in the country that called that vote. It was. Who they were.
Stocks and Jacks.
Stocks and Jacks.
Yes, and
We had our reporter.
Oh, you about Brexit? Oh, absolutely, Tom. Yeah.
We had it wasn't because of me. We had our reporter on the scene, a Fed gentleman who goes the name of Robert, was over in London, and he goes, everybody, he actually texted me from over there, and he goes, this thing is going to lose, or it's going to win. The government lost, right? So Brexit won. Right. I don't know.
Brexit won, yeah.
So he texted me, he goes, he was in London. Whenever he goes someplace, he was in London, I think, on the government's dime, and he was doing some seminar or conference. But he's one of these guys that really likes history. And where's Admiral somebody's boat? Is it down in Portsmouth?
The Navy, the naval port.
Yeah, the one with the big wooden boat that's still down there. Was it Admiral Nelson's?
Nelson, yeah.
So he takes the train down to Portsmouth. He goes, once you get out of London, where everybody was convinced the thing was going to win, you know, was going to lose by a landslide, as soon as you got on the train, there was nobody voting to stay. He goes, the minute you get out of London, he goes, this thing's going to lose. Plus, they must have some very odd, and this is sort of indicative of here in our last election, or maybe the one where either one Trump got in, and maybe even the last one, is the polling is kind of weird. But I think from what Robert explained to me is a lot of people, you know, where they always do the thing about what do they call it, likely voters. They poll a bunch of likely voters. Remember, they always use that term. And how they define that, you know, got, I mean, it's above my pay grade, but somehow or another, in Britain, people must not leave their addresses for, like, forever. I mean, I don't know. I'm fishing here for the reason, John, and you guys can help me out. But bottom line is, they did all these polls of likely voters, and Brexit was a loser. But they ended up with how many people that were unlikely voters voted? People they never even dreamed that they would have to. So somehow or another, there were people that stayed in, you know, like your apartment and lived there for 30 years and hadn't voted in the last five elections. All of a sudden, you got your ass down the block and voted. So the amount of people that essentially came out of the woodwork, they must still have been registered and hadn't voted in a while, that were not in the, quote, likely voter catalog. That's what turned it all around. Is people that were not likely voters. And my question is, do we have that same sort of phenomenon here? People here seem to move more, so you probably have to re-register wherever you go, so they have probably a better handle on it. But if I didn't walk down the block for a decade, where would they put me? Why would they even consider me, a voter? I mean, if our precinct, every single time there's a vote is, you know, 500 people, and all of a sudden out of the blue there's 1,000. I mean, they would never even canvass the other 500, would they? How would you even know they were around?
No, I mean, there's no money to do that, and there's, you know, the results or the information that would yield isn't that useful to the people who like to crunch it. But I think one of the reasons, there's an uptick too in the participation in the EU parliamentary elections. It looks like it's over 50% this time around. Well, these are rough estimates that are likely to change, but that the pattern had been a declining participation as people began to lose interest in the whole thing. And now when people realize what's at stake, it seems to have boosted participation. The polling issue is a different question entirely, I think, Tom. You're right about the, you know, likely voters and how many of them would not have normally voted in such an election did go out, so they, you know, skewed the polls completely. But I think people are distrusting the polling process itself. They don't like the way it's, you know, turned into just a kind of, you know, lobbying tool, and, you know, they are resistant to giving out much information about their political alignment. If somebody just calls them up on the phone, starts asking a lot of questions, a lot of people are suspicious of how that information is handled, how discreet it is, how protected it, how private it is, and how this can result in retaliations or job discrimination or anything else. People never were that resistant in the past to the polling process, and I think now this is something that's much less reliable because people see it as much less, you know, reliable as a dispassionate indicator of anything. It's becoming a tool for political partisans to crush the other side. So,
well, John, how do you, when people had landlines, and I had one the whole time I re-established mine during COVID because I figured if we ever couldn't get in the office, I wanted to have a landline, which is, you know, much better if you're in a conference call or anything than a cell phone, even though people think that's not true. That it is true. Because you can tell here on Snacks and Jacks if people call in on a phone that's a landline versus a cell. It's clear. Anyway, I don't know why, but I always, if somebody called me on my landline and it was a poll, I just seem, since they've been doing it forever, a little little more likely to, I mean, I know this is really stupid to think this way, but I guess calling somebody's house, I never thought was that big when your number was in the phone book and anybody could find it and all that stuff. It was kind of a different world. I never thought that was as big of an intrusion as if I'm talking to a client at work or something. All of a sudden, my cell phone goes off. I don't know why I have that incredible difference of opinion on whether a poll call or a spam call is on my cell versus my landline. I mean, I know it's probably dumb on my part, but I still feel that way. I mean, I don't want to be bugged on my cell phone. I mean, I'm at work with that phone, right? I mean, I don't want to be answering a thing for some moron when I'm talking to a client or something. So, I mean, to me, it's a difference, but how do you even find these people? Because I do know from my way back in the day, my statistics stuff, we did a big thing on random sampling, both at Notre Dame and the University of Chicago. And it's the trick is, random sampling works well. If I'm going to date myself here and say, if you pull out a random number table and you figure out, okay, we're gonna have 1,000 people we're going to poll, you can do a pretty good random sample with 12 people. Or 15 or something, or, you know, forget the actual number. But you better get those 15. If you don't, you just blow the whole thing, right? I mean, you can't ask the person across the street. You can't ask the person on Michigan Avenue because he might be different than the person you're trying to get. The whole idea is it needs to be random. And I don't know how the hell, if 10 people don't, you know, slam the phone down and say, what are you calling me on my cell phone, and you don't get those people, you can't just pick the next 10. I mean, or else you need a gazillion more people in the sample, right?
Yeah. It isn't surprising, Tom. You know, when you get, you know, phishing schemes or spoofing schemes where, you know, a lot of the calls you get on a landline or on a cell phone, you have no idea of the origin of these calls. I mean, the fraudulent placement of data with phony data, so the caller ID has become pretty meaningless, I think, as any kind of a screening tool to decide, is this the real deal, this thing that's calling me? Is it a machine? Is it a complete fake? Is it a fraud? Is it totally misleading? I think people see polling now as falling into the same category. You don't know who is making a call to you, whether it's somebody related to your boss or, you know, somebody that has, you know, every reason maybe to get you out of there if you have incriminating, you know, information about yourself, or you're on the wrong side of the political spectrum. Who's to stop some political operative from faking a poll and, you know, using that information against you and then setting you up to try to prove what really happened? How would you go about doing that? So no wonder people are skeptical of participating.
Well, when Trump won, I certainly am. And I mean, this is not any disparaging against him, but the polls showed Hillary out in front, because if you poll people like at train stations or downtown, back when downtown had people who were working, when you did that, you got a totally different view of the world than if you somehow could find a way to find the people that aren't working, right?
Right.
Well, I mean, why aren't you working? Well, I got laid off. Well, does that mean you're happy with the current administration? No, it means I'm gonna vote for whoever is a change artist, right? I mean, there's totally different views on if you get the wrong person or not. I mean, it just is. That's why, I mean, I still remember that from courses years ago. So I'd not want to be a pollster today. I mean, I don't know how I'd even do it. Unless you...
Well,
How would you even do it?
Well, the people have gotten, you know, I think justifiably too, have gotten smart about this. When you've got, you know, national candidates like Hillary calling people who disagree with her deplorables merely because they disagree with her and are likely to vote for her opponent. But when that's the kind of characterization you have of a whole group of people who are just as entitled to vote as the people who supported her, and you phrase it that way, and you know, it gets, you know, bandied around as if you are a deplorable. I mean, people began to use that as a badge of honor just because she used it in a disparaging way. But what, why would you trust pollsters for her or somebody else either?
Well, I mean, if you look at some of the way
they feel about you, why would you give them any information about yourself? I think the Trump election in 2016 was almost a foregone conclusion after Brexit. I thought too after Brexit, which I thought would you know win, but I didn't think it would be as convincing a win as it was. But I thought wait till the 2016 presidential election a couple months later, and you'll see the same phenomena. And I think, you know, it's the whirlwind has been unleashed, I guess, as Chuck Schumer would say.
Well, everybody is upset with the current, you know, current government, seemingly every country, every level. So we keep switching people back and forth. But I don't know that the solutions, should there be one, anybody wants any part of. I mean, the solution for stuff that is... that we're broke, the solution, I mean, I think we can make some solutions in terms of how much we're paying medical people and those kinds of things. I mean, there's a lot to be done there, but I mean, not like there aren't cost solutions. There are. Basically, people are not paying enough in and getting too much out. I mean, it's, you know, that's, I don't want anybody's Social Security getting cut, and I don't want to have to pay more taxes, but when you're taking in only 60% of what you're putting out, well, guess what? There's only two ways to change that number, right? Now, because of the medical side, you maybe could change it by clamping down on what hospitals and drug places. You maybe could do that, but you're not gonna stop your military pensions, right? You're not gonna stop those kinds of things. You're not gonna cut those by 40%. Well, you know, there's no way you're doing that. So somewhere along the line, it's some combination of revenue and cutting costs if you're going to get anywhere near even. I mean, duh. I mean, if you actually were to come out and say what you needed to do to straighten out government, who the hell would vote for you, Jen? I mean, nobody.
No, that's the bag we're in now, Tom.
Yeah, it's the bag we're in. And nobody wants any sort of enforcement of any kind of law. I mean, last night I drove from the south side north, and I'll say I wasn't on the Ryan a mile and a half before at least five cars went by me. I was going 70, and I felt like I was in a stagecoach. I mean, it was a minimum of 100 miles an hour. Okay, now, there's no policeman anywhere. Nobody wants to pull anybody over. If you pull anybody over to the wrong race, I mean, it's absurd. Whatever excuse we have, we can't enforce any law. And everybody who pulls over, they're going 105. You pulled me over because I was black. How the hell can I even see if you're black? You get illegal tinted windows. How can I, even if I wanted to, I couldn't wait till the black guy went by, because I don't even know who you were. I can't see you. I mean, it's reached bizarre world time all over the place. And I don't know, you know, certainly in every kind of government. But if you were, what did Simpson Bowles say? Are those two guys still alive? I mean, they were old when they did this stuff. They did the overall study in Obama administration of the federal budget and what they would have to do to get it in line. And what did the one guy say, the tall guy? He goes, if you're not pissed off, you either didn't read it close enough or we somehow missed you.
Or something. It was Al Simpson from there.
Yeah, one of those guys. yeah, which is true, right? I mean, we somehow missed you. I mean, you know, the people that are got their nose up the ass of government the most are the ones that are crying for the deficit to come down. They don't want their gravy train stopped. You know, and I talked to Kevin yesterday at length about the border stuff, and you know, he's talking about the way to do it properly and how many people it would take to do that quote properly. You know, you actually had embarkation ports where if somebody came in, you actually would find a way, before you let them go into the country, you would find a way to see whether the people had a legitimate asylum claim, blah, 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 that you took drug tests. You did all the right stuff. I can't even imagine the personnel and the money that would take, John. I mean, I can't even... And then we talked last week, and we'll talk again this week about maybe if there's going to be some kind of a... I won't use the term real war, because all wars are real... an extended war or something going on, even in the Red Sea, which seems to have toned down some, in Ukraine, that all of a sudden all the stuff we didn't think we needed, naval supply ships, naval oilers, we have the ability to supply people at sea with more cruise missiles and whatever they use. We evidently we've let that slide. Now, in the article that Lou sent around, he said they should take a big look at the ships we have in quote in mothballs. And he thinks a lot of those could probably be, refitted and sent out. Now, our man Professor Hal was on a cruiser that was older, I guess, and said the amount of maintenance with people on there that they did the maintenance every day was astronomical. And he can't imagine dragging one of these things that's been sitting at a dock for 20 years and getting the thing going again. So even on that, we have people on the show, not that we have an article plus a person, that there's a debate right there. I mean, none of these things are easy things. I mean, do we really want to piss away how many million dollars, dragging old ships back? But you know what? All of a sudden, this whole idea that every battle is going to be 12 days and our aircraft carriers, which are untouchable, they're okay even if we have not much behind them. I don't know if that's the right plan going forward either, do you? I mean, every one of these things is a huge debate. And we'll talk about this more after the break. Every one of these things is a huge issue and a huge debate. I don't see anybody around who seems to sit down and actually want to go through it and do the right thing, do you? I mean, whatever the right thing is. It's anyway.
Well, there's no patience for having a debate about the things you're talking about, Tom. And this is the ultimate kind of depths to which we've sunk. We're in no business to be thinking about fighting any war, limited or otherwise, with the kind of issues we have that we have no interest in even studying, let alone trying to correct or reverse somehow. So the idea that we'd somehow be able to fight a war and to succeed at it, our track record, even in better times, has been none too good.
Except you don't get to pick when you fight a war, or the other side kind of picks. I mean, you don't get to choose. Yeah, choose wars. We have chosen a few. But anyway, S&P Futures down 3.25, NASDAQ Futures down 7. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Well, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. Tom Howell. He's Greg Pappas on the board. S&P Futures down 4, NASDAQ Futures down 10, so we're leaking a little. We've got the CPI number Wednesday and PPI on Thursday. Jenna, we'll talk a little bit about the administration came out with this weekend regarding the border stuff. And the details of it, if it exceeds a certain amount per day, they're not going to let, whatever it is. It has managed to piss off pretty much everybody because I want to relate a little bit about a personal experience years and years ago that I was involved in, and God, Jenna hated it. The reason why, when the DPM's specialists, CBOE was always an open outcry, it was an independent market maker floor. And as time went by and there were competing exchanges, when I say competing exchanges, the exchanges always competed with each other, but they never competed for order flow in an individual stock. In other words, IBM was traded at the CBOE. Digital Equipment was traded at American Stock Exchange. So for every individual security, there was only one spot where buyers and sellers came together, which, in my opinion, is still the best way to do it, and that spread all over the place because you ended up having much more retail and people trade with each other instead of every trade being done by somebody else and front run and all the other kind of crap that happens now. But that's just kind of one man's opinion. But, John, when they first said the DPMs, some stocks were given to DPMs, and the idea was that these were stocks, that new stocks that nobody else really wanted. And so that was going to go in sense of a quasi-specialist system. And the person who was the specialist, the DPM, was entitled to a pro rata share, according to the rules, of every trade, if he wanted it. In other words, if he didn't hear the trade or a broker came in, he could demand a pro rata share of any ticket. Well, since there are only a few people in some of these crowds, the DPM started taking half of everything. Okay, and this went on for like quite a while. So their definition of pro rata was half, which, you're an English major, you know that's not exactly the definition, right? I mean, it's not even close, right? So, but over time, that became the, whatever you want to call it, the staple. And so now there's this committee that they call it the Modified Trading Committee. And it was you had to go through the nominating committee and you had to be selected for this committee. So somehow or another, I land on this committee. Now, I'm an OAX trader, so I don't really have skin in the game. I have people that are trading in some of these other crowds, but I didn't like the whole idea of going DPM, so I was not part of it. So Bill Florsch, who was then vice chairman, does me the tremendous thing of making me chairman of this committee, right? Which I needed an extra nose on my face. But being the good lad that I am, or was, I mean, I take over the chairmanship of this thing. And now all of a sudden, basically the bleep hits the fan that some of these crowds are getting big enough to where they've got, so many stocks have grown up to where they're real stocks, and there's 20, 30 people in there. And the DPM is taking half of every trade, and everybody's going, wait a minute. This isn't pro rata, which, of course, it wasn't. So now on this committee, I have a couple guys that are DPMs, a couple of member firm guys who love the specialists because they got everything done to them, taking out the dinner, you name it. The gravy flowing on those guys was great. Then you had some market makers on there that said, hey, I want my share that the rules said I'm supposed to get. John, there was zero middle ground. I screwed around with this for a year. There was the only saving me and the committee was everybody knew that I was, quote, A, honest, and B, didn't have any skin in the game, or else it really would have degenerated into God knows what. But finally, Bill Florsch, the vice chairman, terrific guy, he was on a committee. Finally, I said, you know what? I'm really tired of this. I said, everybody who comes in here, you were nominated. Your firm, your boss was not. So put your head at the friggin' door, and I slammed my hand down on the table, and I said, we are going to come to a solution here. The 50% going on forever to all you guys that are DPMs, that's not going to be the solution. And you other guys, to think that DPM's going to drop down and just be like a regular guy, that's not going to be the solution either. So what are we going to do? And Bill was like, hey, you can't do that. I mean, Bill, I'm tired of this. I'm just tired of it. I mean, meeting after meeting of my time, I mean, screw this. We're in the middle someplace. So we ended up with a solution that pissed everybody off. But the only thing they couldn't do is be mad at me because I didn't benefit from it. But this border thing, I've got one of my red-haired, redneck buddies, is that polite to say, out of a western suburb, I don't want one of these people in this country, they're all crooks, they're all whores, they're all diseased, I don't want one person here, we don't need another soul here. Now, of course, the guy came here, his grandparents came here off the boat from Ireland, so they were an immigrant. And then yesterday, one of the people from the other side, some lady comes on and says, if this thing from Biden delays 25 people even a day, how inhumane it is and blah, 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 because these people all have asylum problems and they all have other stuff. They need to be here. They can't be where they can't go back to where they were. It's a hellhole and blah blah blah. How the hell do you find a middle on that, John? I mean, you could take the as much as we bitch about Obamacare, and much as nobody liked, you know, Hillary's plan going nowhere. The fact is, George Bush for 8 years sat in the middle and just ignored it. that's not a solution either. You know, well, what is the solution? You got to do something here. You know, what is it? You can't get those people in a room.
It's pretty clear that you can't begin the negotiating or discovery process for a solution by starting at the center. This is what's become so skewed about the whole thing. You can't say let's think of the reasonable thing to do here. You really have to look at how unreasonable the situation has become, and the only way to fix it is to be equally unreasonable in the opposite direction. And this, of course, is people are even less prepared for. But you got to think at least to some extent. What else can we do but be unreasonable when we've thrown open the border? So yes, there are good people that we'd like to have here, and there's other people not so good. But the problem we have in the way the border is administered is we don't care what they are. It's unimportant whether they are thugs or just recently released from jail or have how many fake IDs or flown in here from China. If that's the case, well, there's nothing we can do about that, so be it. It makes me laugh every time I see these news stories covering the mass swearing-ins at the federal building in Chicago, where they've got a whole new crop of citizens who are taking the oath of citizenship. And, they're feel-good stories because, there's a lot of love behind each one of those individuals' choice to do this. But always in the back of my mind is a question I'd like to ask these people. Why do you want to be a citizen of a country that pays so little attention to citizenship? What's in it for you? Are you just doing this for some good moral reason?
Well, maybe you want to, when you send your Social Security check in, you at least, it's on a number that they count, and they don't just accept the money knowing nobody has the number.
Right,
like they used to do.
All of your benefits are going to supply people who didn't do what you did, and the government doesn't think any less of them than they do of you.
Well, no, none of those people are going to
be part of this bracket.
Well, none of those people are going to get a Social Security check with a fake card. But they'll take their money. At least they used to. I knew people who ran restaurants 30 years ago and said they knew these guys had a fake Social Security card. Yet the money never came back. Anyway,
well, they got how many benefits going out to people who were born in the 1860s then?
Well, it's a...
On their Social Security... I mean, that to me says you don't care if they're, 150 years old or this, history with citizenship.
Hey, the guy who... His daughter was still getting Civil War benefits. You should... The guy ended up having, three daughters when he was in his 90s? This is before Viagra? Yeah. Before Viagra? This guy had some good genes. Just saying.
Yeah, but, I mean, they have people who are getting Social Security benefits whose birth date is in the 1860s, and nobody has screened these out. So.
No, it's bureaucracy, but it's just, I would like to start, John, and I don't know where I even would begin to do this. Somehow, some way, when I talked a little bit about yesterday, I want to know if the collective we is part of the problem here, and I don't know how to even go about this, because, at our reunion, we talked about one of the gentlemen who was Tim and Kevin's brother Tim's roommate freshman year, Mario Cardinal.
Cardinal, yeah.
And he was from
Nicaragua.
Nicaragua, and his family was kind of on the outs with the guys were in Nicaragua at the time. His family had money, right? I mean, we're talking 50 years ago, and Nicaragua hasn't gotten any better. Now, are we? I don't know enough about the place to say it hasn't gotten any better, but it doesn't seem like it's gotten that much better. Are we part of this holding pattern? I mean, are the people, the businesses, the U.S. businesses and, Dutch businesses and whoever else are down there, are we just so we can get in the door and do our business and take what we plan on taking, and not that we're not paying for it, are we part of keeping this old government alive? I mean, because we must have to pay them to get in the door, right? Are we part of why Venezuela is Venezuela today, or Nicaragua is Nicaragua today? The reason why I ask is I have a friend who has this I won't go into the detail of it because I'm not so sure I understand all of it. She has a mathematical system, a programming system that allows you to keep all kinds of things, keep track of stuff. So it's not math in the sense that, you know, 2 plus 2 equals 4, but it, anyways, but she was recruited by the United Nations to do something, and it's a long story we'll talk about today. Basically, they wanted to be able to do scans of container shipments at port of embarkation and demarcation, right? And if the scans didn't match, to reject the thing. Basically, they started at a couple of African countries. And she ended up with a UN passport and everything. By the way, they're a really nice shade of purple. They're pretty neat-looking passports, because you showed them to me. She doesn't have it anymore because of the corruption. They ended up in one place. The UN was going to have a Swiss bank account for the tyrannical dictator, because he wanted a piece of everything you did. So, you know, if they were going to shoot a picture of this container, say it's $1,000, the guy was going to get like $5 or $10 in his Swiss bank account for every container. Now, I'm sure probably the UN would rather this guy not be there, but how the hell is he ever going to get tossed out if they're giving him money to stay there? I mean, I guess, you know, go back to Harry Truman. You know, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch, right? I mean, is our dying to get oil out of Venezuela essentially propping these people? Are we supporting them, the bad government, and actually getting in the middle of what normally would be a revolution, or who knows, bloody or otherwise, decade after decade, so there never is the bloody revolution or whatever it would take to throw these people? I mean, I don't know. It seems like something's really odd here. What should have happened hasn't happened, and nothing gets any better. And the people there, with populations, you know, growing, which they are, just want the hell out. And we seem to be the only spot they can go. I mean, where along the chain here you find the solution, I have no idea. Do you?
No. Well, take Nicaragua, you know, just follow up on that example. But, you know, the crooked operation that we supported in Nicaragua for a long time then was undercut by, you know, Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas and the 70s, the freedom fighters. And of course, what do? Is we start, you know, Iran-Contra as a way of funneling money to the Sandinistas. So we're, you know, trading on the Iranians' money and arms to get, you know, weapons in the hands of the Sandinistas. That whole thing flopped. We've got Ortega now, you know, was pretty much like Maduro in Venezuela. It was, you know, nationalized the Catholic universities in Nicaragua, just taking them over, kicked out the religious. It's just what Castro did in Cuba, and we shouldn't get started on Cuba because that's the same thing all over again too. Yes, we are to blame for the way things played out, that we either didn't have enough foresight or we held off, you know, against, you know, all indications of what we thought we were doing there and how it play out over the long haul. We completely misread the signals, and now we've got case after case of this in Central America, Mexico to some extent too, where it certainly hasn't improved our relations with Mexico. It's likely to get a lot worse with the new president they have now. So I just don't see any kind of foresightedness that you would expect career diplomats or people in the State Department to have studied and have watched develop and unfold in particular ways, and, you know, try, you know, their darndest not to let this happen again. But it does happen again, and, you know, and a lot of people profit by it's happening over and over again too. And you can't extract the profit from the formula anymore, it seems. So I'm not surprised. We are responsible for a lot of what we are handed today. Same thing in Iran. I mean, we've coddled the Iranian, you know, militants, despite what our, you know, protestations have been. And now we've got someone we really can't call an ally, but we don't seem to want to call an enemy either. You can't have it both ways. So,
well, I mean,
the list goes on and on.
Well, the Iranian situation, somehow or other, we shouldn't have taken out Iraq, because they were our buffer, but we foolishly did that. But, you know, I always wanted to play. Actually, I had a client who wanted to play Olympia Fields, right? So, you know, who do I call? Our buddy, not Dr. J, our other buddy, Doc, because he knows everybody. I said, Doc, hey, can you get us on Olympia Fields? He goes, sure, because he knows everybody. So we went down there and play, and we ended up having cocktails with the guy who got us on the course. And he's a former priest that was over in the Far East and Korea and some other place. And now he's not a priest anymore, but he's a member of Olympia Field. So he's telling us, and he was giving us stories about what was happening, you know, what the CIA was doing when he was teaching in South Korea. And how he was teaching about labor unions, and the CIA guy showed up in his class and said, "We don't want you teaching labor unions over here." You know, this is, you know, 25 years ago. But he says, you know, he goes, "America is the greatest country in the world when you're living here." He said, "When you're somewhere else, you realize that America is nothing more than the military arm of big business. And they don't care about whether these other places, they care about business doing business in those places, and the government will let them do it. Whatever they do to their people, nobody cares about." And, you know, I'm sitting there going, the guy's had a few cocktails, and I didn't take too much of it, you know, to heart, but I'm wondering if he isn't right, John, in a lot of places.
He is right, Tom.
Well, how do we stop that? Because when you do that, 30 years later, there's a bill to pay, and we're always the people that are paying the bill. I don't know how you do. So I'm saying this whole border thing is not as simple as don't let anybody in and let everybody in. How did it get to this point? I mean, what's happening here? Who's making money at it? How horrible is it to live in Nicaragua or God knows where the rest of these places are? I mean, the guy, if there is such a thing as a heaven, the guy who's got to go straight to heaven is the guy who runs Jordan, right? So what's it, half his population is refugees? Or something along those lines, yeah. And still somehow they manage to feed everybody and do something. I don't know how he does it, but I don't know how well they're getting fed. But I'm saying, you know, how many people, you know, when you have this discussion in a library or a bar, say, does anybody realize what's the number up to, Jenner? There's like 7 or 8 million people that are on the move worldwide. I mean, they can't live where they used to live. I mean, it's got to be more. What do you do with that many people, for God's sake?
Well, and how much of that, you know, forced migration is our responsibility or the responsibility of our allies, you know, in the kind of disruption that we foment or the kind of economic dislocation that we support, and, you know, the slave labor that we, you know, are perfectly happy to, you know, benefit from, although we can't, you know, have it here, nor do we ever want it here. But it's okay if it's elsewhere. We'd look the other way about it. So who find the hypocrites in this room?
Well, I mean, how many just on pollution? It's okay if we buy blue jeans from China and they pollute, but we don't want anybody polluting in our backyard here, so we throw everybody out of work. I mean, it's like, you know.
Or what's worse, I was saying, we don't care if the Chinese or the Indians pollute to their heart's content. We won't pollute, but we'll just, you know, drive ourselves into economic oblivion so that they can do what we would never do. This is ridiculous.
Well, what is, I mean, what, how do you... How do you get people in a room? These are massive issues. How do you get people, you know, like my little position on my committee? How do you get people to sit down and actually come to a solution and walk out? That's the solution. You couldn't have done any better. That's it. We're moving forward, and eventually everybody does, right? But you need a solution someplace, and you can't just keep arguing about it. Or do the George Bush. I realize healthcare is a problem. It looks like it's too tough for me. I just sit here for 8 years and ignore it as a problem. That's not the solution either. I mean, how do you?
Well, that's the attitude of everybody in the House of Representatives and the Senate too, and to some extent in every city council or, you know, smaller political unit, state legislature you can find. They're all in that same kind of, you know, mindset. This is not these problems are so big I can't fix them.
Well, I mean, someplace. All these people, I don't think they're, in some ways, they're probably not all that bright in terms of what you and I know about some subjects, but they're a hell of a lot brighter than we are in terms of getting elected, because they're elected and we're not, right? Not that we want to be, but if we did, I wouldn't get very far. I don't know how to do it. What, someplace, somewhere, all these people must understand that, for instance, paying $1,000 for a drug that costs $5, not only is it probably not correct to do, but by the way, we just can't do it. It's just like, we really can't let people retire at age 50 that are going to live to 90, because we can't pay people for 65 years and they only work 25. It's not a question of whether we want to. The question is, we can't. But how does somebody run for office with the idea of changing some pension laws? How do you run for office saying we're going to take apart the big drug companies when they're the ones that are financing your campaign? We seem like we're paralyzed. Yeah? I mean, and these are really, really tough issues. I mean, how does one representative or 10 representatives decide we're going to take apart, I won't say take apart in the sense we're firing everybody, how do we make some rationale to the drugs versus patents versus this versus research versus who pays for the stuff? I mean, we had young Katie Ann, and she talked about all the people that contribute to the research. And then all of a sudden, one guy gets a patent. Who's the guy? How does the school not participate? How do the people who worked on it for 5 years, how do they not participate? And all of a sudden now for the next 17 years, somebody's charging $1,000 for something that costs five. How do you take all these would be a 3 or 4 year study and change if you had 20 dedicated people doing it. We don't have 20 dedicated people. It just goes on and on. I mean, how do our guys stop bitching at each other fast enough to actually solve something? I mean, you wonder, you go back in history, the stuff that Roosevelt did, the New Deal, wasn't the, I was going to say the deal, no pun intended, wasn't the story there that he brought Congress back, or the Congress, I don't know if he can bring them back, but he brought Congress back in some horribly hot summer in Washington, was it 1933 or whatever it was, and there was no air conditioning at the time, and they ended up a meeting outside and everybody's sweating. Finally, they assigned whatever they had assigned so they'd go home or something along those lines. It was almost like put everybody.
It's not like something Obama did. He'd hold everybody Congress hostage over the Christmas holidays and cut into their vacation just to be a pimp about it.
Well, but I mean, these are laws that probably, I don't know if they were child labor laws or what they were, but they were something along those lines. It probably should have been signed easily, but people got, I mean, this is not new, but I mean, nobody wants 14-year-olds working, do they? I don't think. I mean, 16's probably bad enough. But it used to be 14, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I guess I don't understand how we get to the point where we actually solve some of this stuff. Or manage it or something. Maybe you don't solve everything. But I don't even see the debate going on, do you?
No. Well, look what the debate is about, Tom. I mean, the so-called, you know, border initiative that Biden came up with is laughable on every count. His administration wasted, you know, no minute once they got into office to dismantle the entire border control operation as it had existed by executive order. And then all of a sudden, well, we can't use executive orders to undo the mess we created by executive orders. So we just have to, you know, do something else. And then the so-called solution, the product of this, is so far from being any kind of a solution, it's nothing other than just a, you know, smokescreen to make it look like I can do something.
Well,
what are you going to do about it? Absolutely nothing. And you could have said the border is closed. I mean, and
I don't know how you do that.
Wildly gone out of control. I think the way to do it is to completely shut it down.
How do you do that? It's a thousand. How many miles long?
Well, you do it by enforcing the laws that have always
been.
Well,
but I'm saying we don't have anywhere near. I mean, the idea that, you know, just because Trump, you know, pontificates like a rooster, I mean, we don't have anywhere near the personnel, nor do we want to say we want to. If 4 million people show up, somebody's getting over. I mean, we don't have anywhere near that. I mean, in Arizona, the whole thing's mountainous. There's no wall going up
and
there.
And it's because we've encouraged that kind of migration form.
Well,
let's face it.
Well, there's no question, John, that if you...
Oh, we can't fix it now because we broke it so bad, can't fix it. That's BS.
Well, we got to go to break here, but there's no question that if you make it anywhere comfortable for anybody and be humane about it, you're going to encourage more people to get here. If you shot everybody who got here, we probably wouldn't want to do that. You'd discourage people from getting here. But there's got to be a middle there somewhere, isn't there? anyway, SP Futures down. That's what I'm saying. This is a pretty tough issue. SP Futures down 3, NASDAQ Futures down. How many people over break, Jan? We got a little water coming back, talk about real estate. But how many times would we have to double or triple the resources down there to do it right? I mean, do we have the dough? Do we have the people? So we'll be right back. Stacks
and Jacks. Better find the dough, Tom, because it won't be a question of having any dough anywhere else to do anything.
Same thing can be said for homeless and for others. We'll be right back after break.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. At PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Low and off-back Stocks and Jocks. I'm Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures down 3, NASDAQ futures down 12, so slightly lower. We've got the CPI coming out on Wednesday. We have the Dow futures down 24. I don't really see anything. The only stock I see doing kind of move here, and this is after earnings, is CrowdStrike's up $21. They're not in the Dow or anything. In the Dow, I don't really have anything moving over a dollar. Apple up 99 cents, so that's slightly less than a dollar. But everything is pretty quiet this morning because we've got the numbers, like I said, this week. And we have a Fed meeting as well coming up over in Europe. These guys are rocking a little bit. Macron, again, John and I talked a little bit about that. The people evidently who won for the European election for that parliament evidently weren't Macron's party. It was a big surprise, so he's dissolving parliament. He's calling for a snap election. If his group loses that one, I think he's out. John will confirm that or deny that after the break, but I mean, somehow or another, it's moving fast over there because the French market, the CAC runs down 1.6%, down 124, FTSE down 17.2%, DAX down 86.5%, so the other market's not as bad. But that's a big surprise, I think. Nikkei up 354.9%, Hang Seng down 109.6%, Shanghai up 2, call that flat, so mixed over in Asia. Friday, we're down a little bit. Dow down 87, S&P down 6, NASDAQ down 40. That's not very much considering how much we were up earlier in the week. Bonds up 3 basis points, 4.46. The Bund up 5 basis points, 2.27. Japan up 6 basis points, back over 1%, 101.04. Oil up 79 cents, still in the middle of the 70s. Oil is 76.32. Went up 78 cents, 80.40. Natural gas up 14 cents, 306. God, what a nice buy that was at 178. I wish I had some. RBOB up a penny, 239. We've got gold, which got annihilated on Friday with some Chinese reports saying that it was the biggest sell-off in 3.5 years. The China said, well, they weren't buying gold anymore or whatever. It's a dollar down another $1.90, 23.22. Silver up 45 cents, 29.89. Copper up 5 cents, 4.53. We have the dollar is down, stronger. The euro is down because of this French thing, I think. Down to 107. It has been almost, it has been 108, so it's down a little bit. Same thing against the pound. Not as much. 127.2. So the dollar may be a little stronger against the pound, but very little. Crypto. Bitcoin's down 342, back under 69 or 70,000, 69,403. A lot of stuff there. What do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Ooh. 7:38 here in Chicago. 54 degrees right now, high of 63. Phoenix 56 now, high of 65 today. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 28 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 47 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 31 minutes. The Ryan 95th in is 18 minutes, and 294 to the Ryan is 29 minutes. Sports. Roland Garros final. Alcaraz beats Zverev. That was a four-hour match, five sets. And Swiatek beat Paolini in the women's final. That was 6-2, 6-1. MLB, Cubs beat Cincy. That was 4-2. White Sox lose to Red Sox at home, 6-4. Arizona wins at San Diego. That was 9-3. NBA Finals, Game 2. Celtics win 105-98 at home. And the Stanley Cup, Game 2 is tonight. Oilers at Panthers. Panthers lead that series 1-0.
How many people are still watching the Stanley Cup with the Oilers and the Panthers in it?
I don't know. It was pretty fun to watch.
Well, man, actually, playoff hockey is about as intense as it gets. I just, who do you think is going to win that one?
Tonight?
Well, no.
I'm going to say Panthers roll tonight.
Okay. There you go. We have John and Audrey?
Yes, you do.
Morning, Audrey.
Good morning, honey. How are you today?
I'm good. And you?
So far, so good.
You know, it's early yet, you know.
I would say you never know. The day is young.
Hey, Odd, your name, you and Nancy's name was being bandied about. Was it on Thursday, Jen? We talked a little bit about this antitrust thing that being lobbed out against. It's an Atlanta company, Jen? Big companies that have essentially bought all these condos and single-family homes and are attempting to set rental prices. At least that's the accusation. And I said, you know, you and Nancy have said that the inroads of those big companies into this area have not been that big yet. I mean, is that still the case?
I know. I've been talking about seeing that. That's why the rentals prices have gone up. You know, that's what happened during the recession. It started where people were scooping. These companies started scooping homes up by the thousands. And that's what happened in Detroit, too. People were buying a lot of distressed cities just going by these companies, by thousands of them. Sometimes they get them for a dollar. They fix them up and sell them. And then they become, you know, it's basically kind of like a rent-controlled housing on the bad side, because the rents will be usually so much higher than the area, or at the very top, the requirements to rent also become so strict that most people can't qualify. So it kind of defeats the whole housing thing.
Well, weren't they saying, Janet, they had so many units they were willing to keep units off the market just to maintain the price. You haven't seen any of that though, have you? Where there's a bunch of places.
No. No, our mortgage problems are doing that for us. We don't have to worry about that.
But I mean, you guys are saying there's nothing vacant anywhere, right? That's decent. Everybody's snapping it up, aren't they?
Yeah, rentals are definitely at a premium, and they are very, very expensive.
You guys, I'd like both of your opinions. Why is that? I mean, Nancy comes on every other week and talks about how she can put people in. Well, she's really good at it, but she's not making the rates. She can put people into housing now, especially with some of the lower down payments, sometimes for significantly less than the things they're renting for. And she's, you know, said, well, I don't see why that is. But what do you think is causing that? But why'd you go first? Is that a long-term thing, or is that just something?
Well, it's just very simple. Well, it's just like houses. There's not enough to go around. So obviously people can charge more. There's nothing new. That's been trending for about past 4 years.
Okay. So what would cause it to come back the other way? Anything?
More housing.
Okay.
You know, I mean, there's nothing there. And people are not moving, you know, with the country and the state it's in. And again, the 3% mortgages, you're not moving. So basically the only housing that's becoming on the market, if somebody dies, gets divorced, gets transferred, some life event that's going to force somebody to move. Otherwise, people are not moving.
Jen, you seeing the same thing?
Yeah, I think, you know, the attraction of owning a house has traditionally had for people over renting has turned into such a, you know, a big bushel of question marks that people are kind of gun shy. You know, interest rates are, you know, higher than they've been. That alone is a discouragement for a lot of people if they can't qualify, for example. But then you've got things like insurance and homeowners association, that, you know, fees that are never have become as big a factor in your monthly nut as they become now, and they show no signs of declining. I think people who, you know, would love to have a backyard and, you know, something they can call their own, look at the long-term expenses of sustaining that, and they shy away from it. And it's kind of too bad, because it isn't like people who rent are shielded from any of those things. You know, the taxes and insurance rates and everything else can be just as important in your monthly nut in a place that's becoming harder and harder to operate, like a condo or even a fleet of rental properties. But I think it's, but you've got some kind of cushion as a renter, because you can leave if you don't like it. You may have to downsize, but you're not stuck with trying to get rid of a building that may not be very attractive at the time you put it on the market. So overall, people are thinking very long term now and seeing, you know, a short term solution to housing as the better one.
Well, out of all the people who, for a long time, condos in like the downtown area, I mean, I'll expand that from total central business district. That, if, you know, some of this, you know, it sounds like I'm being sexist, but I'm not. I mean, because a lot of people, if you go back, certainly before 2007, 2008, if somebody lived in the burbs and more the daughter than the son, because you think the son can take care of himself, but probably can't if he's getting shot at, but if the daughter wanted to move downtown, you weren't going to let her move to, you know, Logan Square or someplace and park her car four blocks away from home and walk home at 1 a.m. You probably wanted her in a building with parking in the place with a doorman or something. And I think mom and pops, basically, you saw the condo market, real estate was a good investment. Even though you think she was only going to be in it for a couple of years, you'd buy the condo and you'd make an investment out of it. And I think a lot of those people, depending on with the COVID and everything else, kind of got clobbered on that investment. So now if you're trying to do the same thing for some member of the family, you're almost willing to bet for a year. Bet's a bad term. You're almost willing to pay $600-$700 more a month, maybe even $1,000, to just get the rental in there and hope she finds a boyfriend and gets married and goes somewhere else. I mean, you're not willing to make the short. I mean, you're not willing to make the short term. I'm going to buy a condo and I'll sell it in 2 years. I think people think that's too risky now. Or am I wrong?
No, I would say that's probably true. People are thinking longer term. Of course, if they do that, then they're hoping that they'll be able to refi at a decent rate in a couple of years. And I think most people who are buying now are hoping for that. So, but it's going to be a play the waiting game type of thing to see what happens. It's obviously such a mess right now that it's tough to play it for anything.
Well, the people that from what you tell me, and I try never to pry because Odd's really good at her business. The last thing she needs is my nose in it. It seems to me that most of the people that I hear you talking to, they're buying what they consider to be their forever home. Now, there are exceptions, but most people are, aren't they? They're not planning on going anywhere. We're not talking about, I'm buying a house for 2 years, I'm going to be in Chicago for 2 years, then I'm moving to Denver because that's what my company's doing. I think a lot of those people now are just saying, screw it, and they're renting. Where before everybody bought, then they even was like for a year or two.
Well,
not everybody, but
I don't think you're seeing a transfer market like you used to. So I don't think that's, at least I'm not in my area. We don't have a lot of that, but people are planning for long term, and they're purchasing with a far more long term view. For I would say you're looking at a 3 to 5 year. That would be about the average year, maybe 5 to 7. Now people are saying, I want something that I'm not leaving. And it's very, very different than it was. They're more willing to expand. People who have to live in Chicago, they're just going to stay in their bungalow, and a lot of those people are putting the second story on and saying, you know, we're just going to stay here until we don't have to live in Chicago, we retire anymore.
Well, out of your last, I don't want to pry too much, but out of your last 20 closings, how many of them would you say don't plan on ever moving again? Or if they do, it's when they're 80 and need a, you know, a smaller place. I'd say most of them, from my view.
With my group, probably, yeah, I would say maybe 12 to 14, so the majority.
Yeah. And you got some people who bought lots that are going to build a house. They're not going anywhere. At least I don't think so.
You know, you never know. But I definitely people are more of a long-term view for this. And again, hoping to refi. But again, that segment that's just sitting there is putting a cramp. It's putting a cramp in everything. I don't believe, you know, we're ever going to see 3% rates again, and probably nor should we. But if things settle down in the 5% to 6% range, you'll see that all the cogs of the wheel start to move, which means that people will start working, the trains will working, the home stores will start working, and again, the average person might actually be able to make a living and have prices come down, because the housing market affects so many industries. It's not just you're buying a house, it's the mortgage people, the attorneys, the sellers, the appraisers, the furniture people, the flooring people, the roofing people, everything that goes into a house. It really does drive so much of the economy.
Well, how does this get back to what we kind of started with? How did these groups get so much power in some areas like Atlanta seemed to be the epicenter of this, right, Jen? How do these groups get so much? They were talking, I mean, you and I were talking about a little bit on that they're holding what? How many apartments off the market just to keep the prices up? I can't even imagine that happening here. It doesn't mean it can't happen, but what? Can you imagine right now with the demand for rentals with people holding 500 rentals off the market to keep the prices up? How would you even pull off here?
I could definitely imagine that in Chicago, no problem.
Really?
Yeah.
Right,
I can imagine that. And so many people have really. It does happen. There's homes. You know, you could buy homes for a dollar if you're in that group. You know, when they go up there, I'm sure there's groups that get sent to the front of the line in front of other groups.
Oh, that would never happen here.
Again, it's who you know who's when you're going to get access to something that's a good deal, and you guys all know that too. So it's when all these things would come, you know. To auction before. I don't know how much it's happening now since the recession. That recession's over, the other one's coming. They would just bundle these homes and people would buy 10, 20, 100, 1,000, whatever kind of company it was.
Jen, so, how much of that is still under this mayor? I mean, there's been programs, like Wad says, there have been programs that if your house next door was vacant and it was a tax sale, you could get in. What, you could pay how much for the place? $100 or $1 or something, and buy the house next door. There have always been these kind of programs that have been out there. Does anybody ever know anybody who's actually done that, that was able to do it? I have. I'm sure people have, but they're not people I know, and they're probably very rich. But
I have a couple of friends who do that and make a fortune out of it.
Really?
But that's different than what we're talking. Tax sale's different than the city just bundling. Well, I think one of the examples was when Chicago thought they were going to get the Olympics. And the whole south side all of a sudden became a valuable place, and people were out grabbing up, you know, as many properties as they could grab. And there was a lot of cheap things going on down there. The people thought they were either going to build Olympic housing or make parking lots or whatever.
Well, that whole area around Washington Park, wasn't it, Jen? All those empty lots all went up.
And how many buildings were demolished around Michael Reese Hospital and have never been rebuilt based on the, you know, the prospect of having the Olympics. So that's, you know, that was kind of a missed opportunity. That some of that was pretty good, you know, had architectural significance and you know, usefulness just as a center for building a development around. And now it's just vacant land.
Yeah, it's a shame. And again, the green triumphed everything, and the planning, yep. And you know, betting on the come that was going to happen.
Well, John, if I ever told you this, or the listeners, Audrey met. Where did we meet that lady, Aud, the older lady that had the house on what's the really high-end street over in near North Side, giant with the real old...
Astor Street?
Yeah, she had an apartment on Astor Street.
Yeah, she was just delightful.
Oh, yeah. She was in marketing. She was a... Get a load of this. Could you imagine this today? She... What did she have on, like, four or five kids, and she marries some guy with, like, six, right? And the guy turned
out...
Yeah,
she was one of the first women in a major marketing company in Chicago, and she actually did not get most of the credit for it, came up with the reach out and touch someone for AT&T.
That was hers. So was, how do you spell cheese, K-R-A-F-T?
Mm-hmm.
What was the other one? It was G.
She came up with four or five. Yeah. She was a brilliant marketer.
It was G. Brings good things to light. Anyway, she married some guy with like six kids, right? The guy's a loser, so she booted the dude out. And she raised and put through college all 10 kids, yeah?
Yep. She was an amazing, funny, smart, talented woman. She's one of the most amazing people that I'd ever met.
Well, one of her daughters was really, I mean, I thought she was real sharp. She was, I think, the banquet and liquor manager for whatever the big hotel that used to be around. Well, it's still there, I guess, around McCormick Place. And when the Olympics was, like, going to be here, and she was telling us the one night, she goes, "You have no idea how much that bid not being here cost us." And I go, "What do you mean?" She goes, "You're talking for 5 years or 6 years. Our hotel, our bar, was going to be the epicenter of every deal. Not every, because there'll be another hotel that goes up. Virtually every deal is going to be struck over a napkin, a martini, and a shrimp cocktail in our place for 6 years. She goes, "It's an enormous amount of cash if you happen to be in the right place at the right time for one of these events." You know, John, I guess if I'd have thought through it, I would have sort of realized it, but boy, it might have been the worst thing to happen for you and me trying to get around in the city during the Olympics, but for the people who had a hot dog stand in the right place, boy, you know, it's really something, right? But like, God's right, all that property around the... Wasn't the Olympic Stadium going to be temporarily built in Washington Park or something?
Yeah, yeah.
And all the property around Washington Park, like God said, every program known to man was coughing up these properties to people. And what are they doing? They still have them, or do they puke them out to somebody else, or what? I don't even... Do you have any idea? Do they still have them, or what? They were built.
I think some
on
people dumped them. Maybe some people are sitting at them. I don't know. That's not something I'm really following. It was just...
Well, why is there so much
interesting to see?
Why, if you take, you know, the train or drive around, but the train's probably safer, when you see all this empty property, why does anybody want it? Can you get it? I mean, I know how the deeds are. Well, I don't know how the deeds are. Somebody asked John. If you go where the Robert Taylor homes were, and you take the Rock Island, and you look east from the tracks to essentially State Street, which is where the Robert Taylor homes were for, how many was it, 2 miles, Jen? There's nothing there. It's just grass. We're talking about, it's not a half a mile, but it's probably 3 blocks times 2 miles, which has got to be what? How many square miles? It's just vacant. Now, is that still owned? Was that owned by the Chicago Housing Authority? Was that
Chicago Housing Authority? Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't owned by Urban, or was the federal thing?
HUD. No,
it wasn't owned by HUD, but it was owned by the Housing Authority. Now, if you wanted to buy it, can they even get you the deed, or how does that even work? Are those deeds all tied up, or what?
Well, a lot of that was, you know, re-subdivided to conform to the footprint of the buildings that were built there. There had been, you know, single family lots all up and down all of those streets. You know, 30-foot lots by 125 or something. Alleys that, you know, all obliterated, and the thing was just, you know, a single tax parcel, probably one per building, I think, the way it was when there used to be a building there. And you know, you could make some sort of a planned unit development out of it where you'd reconfigure the streets, and this has been done in some neighborhoods that needed...
Well, they did sort of that in Cabrini, but I think they ended up putting leasing that property for 100 years or some of it, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't all owned by them, you know, in perpetuity. But, you know, the thing that's working against it, Tom, yes, there's a lot of vacant land, and, you know, it's got, you know, sewer, it's got water, it's got electricity, it's got all the things that you would have to put in if you were building this out in farmland. So you can tap right into it. But the problem is, once you buy a lot there and expect to build something on it, you're still in a neighborhood that's a food desert.
Yeah.
It is not very safe. It doesn't have good schools. It doesn't have any kind of appeal for subsequent purchasers, like where you can turn this around and this is going to be some kind of vibrant place in 5 or 10 years. You can't bank on that. It was different when they built Dearborn Park, remember, at the south end of the loop around Polk Street, which was old railroad land that had, you know, nothing on it. And that was close, you know, was walkable to downtown Chicago when downtown Chicago was kind of a magnet for something like that. And to some extent, you know, made a lot of sense because there were services that came in there later that made it a viable neighborhood for singles or small families. But to do that elsewhere in a neighborhood that has been depopulated for some time now, I just don't see there being enough appeal to buyers en masse to come in and settle there. They're taking too much of a gamble that this thing will ever be able to sustain itself as a neighborhood.
Well, the driver would have to be, in one man's opinion, and I'll get your guy, the driver would have to be somebody dropping some huge factory along the railroad tracks on the south side that's going to employ 3,000 people in two shifts or something. I mean, it's something,
right.
Then all of a sudden, you're going to want to live close, you're going to want to live everything, and oh, by the way, we'll straighten out the neighborhoods. You follow the dough. Hey, we only got a couple of minutes, but
Well, remember, this was the cachet in the Obama Center project. We're going to put this in a neighborhood that will, you know, all this stuff will accrete to it. All this stuff will grow up around the Obama Center if we put it in a neighborhood that really needs some kind of, you know, burst of energy. Where do they end up locating it? In Jackson Park, in Hyde Park, you know, in a neighborhood that really doesn't need much of an injection of anything. In fact, it's going to be the ruination probably of the park and the surrounding neighborhood. But when they could have done something like what they said their mission statement involved, they didn't do it. So, you know,
well,
who's the bad guy there?
They're right by University of Chicago. Hey, real quick, I mean, this could be you in the future, Greg. Got a call last week from, remember Jessica, Jen?
Yes.
She's interviewing at CNBC. She lives in New York. And wanted to know if they wanted her to have a bachelor's degree, which she does, a nice average and everything. And they want her to have some internship, and would it be all right if she used her internship Stocks and Jocks? I said, sure. God, you did all the traffic weather, you did all the stuff for a while, and she was great. So I was really happy to say, but she told me to. She lives in, what's Queens? What's the other name for this? Astoria or something?
Astoria.
She lives over there. She goes, the problems with, she goes, you go to the subway, and you're tripping over people and needles and, and she goes, it's way worse than Chicago. How bad is it in some of these places? She goes, it's awful out there.
We have no idea, Tom. Bad as it is here.
I mean, where do all these people come from? I mean, like 2 years ago, do they all have a job? I mean, I just...
No, they're all coming across the border, and they're at fentanyl and opioids, and between the Chinese and cartel poisoning our kids and young adults. That's a whole other story, but
yeah,
that's where it's coming
but
from.
But I'm just, I wonder, does anybody, well, this, we got a dash here, but does anybody ever interview, talk about random samples, or does anybody do a random sample of 50 homeless people and say, how did you get here? Do we have any idea where they all came from? Does anybody, or does anybody care?
Nobody cared.
The drugs in all the major cities is so off the charts, and now we have these people that, what could they possibly be fit for when they're basically, there's a new drug on the street and it basically just, it's so lethal, it's some type of zombie drug.
I've heard about that. Well, I guess my question is, though,
what do you do?
The question I'm searching for an answer for here, and we're not going to do it now in 2 seconds. The drugs come after somebody loses the job and they end up on the streets. Or are they the reason they're on the streets in the first place?
Because you have kids who are starting this very young, lack of family support, lack of something to do, lack of people going, you must have a job, you must get good grades. The whole family church structure that kept our country together has been disappearing very rapidly, in my opinion.
Well, I don't disagree. Well, thank you, John. Thank you, Greg. Nice job. As the future's now down 9, as if he's on 42. Again, we're probably in a little bit of a holding pattern until the CPI number comes out on Wednesday. The French thing is a little wrinkle. Doesn't seem to be affecting anybody markets other than the French. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.